Well, thank you so much. I would make one correction, which is the smart people are here because not only did you choose a beautiful place to live, I'm in Washington, but also because I think long before other people figured it out, you understand that all politics is local and that what you do at the local level now more than ever is going to be so critical because it's going to be so hard, as it has been, to get things done at the national level. And these local things are what's going to give inspiration, what's going to trickle up. So I want to thank all of you who have worked so hard to make Santa Cruz a bastion of progressive politics and to show to, some of you are saying you're not. Well, you know, it's all relative. I've been to lots of places and Santa Cruz looks good. The other thing I was thinking as I drove up here last night, I was in Monterey and I was driving up this morning and seeing it is a weekend and the fields were full of people working, full of people working. And I just thought of Donald Trump and thought, you know, he would not have salad at his restaurants were it not for these people working. He would not have food on his plate were it not for the hard work of the immigrant community. And just to think the way he talks about that community, rather than saying, these are the people that get up the earliest, these are the people that work the hardest, these are the people that get the fewest days off, these are the people that contribute the most to our society. Stop calling them rapists and everything else he calls. So instead of launching into Saudi Arabia, I thought I better address the elephant in the room.
Speak.
Donald Trump. And it's been a hard week. I don't know, you know, now there's the people with hindsight who say, oh, I knew he was going to win. But I think most of us really thought, no way this guy's going to be president. As much as people might have talked about voting for him, when they got into the booth, they would have second thoughts. And they'd think about all the horrible things he has said and the terrible example he is for our country and would change their minds. And while, let's remember, Hillary Clinton was a lousy candidate, in any event, she did get more votes. In any event, it's important to understand that Donald Trump won with only 26% of the votes of eligible voters. That is not a majority of people in this country. It's also important to understand, raise your hand if you have a friend or a relative that voted for Donald Trump. Okay, now raise your hand if you would not particularly call that friend or relative a racist. So look around. So there are hands that went up. It's important to say that Donald Trump did attract a lot of racists and allowed them to come to the fore. But he also attracted a lot of disaffected people that have many of the same sense of disgust at what our government has become.
Yep.
And while Bernie Sanders might have represented that or the Green Party for a lot of us, for other people, Donald Trump represented that. It is quite amazing that the billionaire, if he is indeed a billionaire, we don't know, became the champion of the working class. But he did. And it is that disaffected feeling that we have in common with a lot of the people who voted for him. Now, also, we have to recognize that not only did people flock to him who were and are racists and misogynists and Islamophobes and hate immigrants, but he has really given a green light to that behavior. And we've seen just in the last couple of days, women with hijabs getting them pulled off in the street, getting punched in the street, Nazi signs getting painted on walls, people in the immigrant community getting beaten up and told to go home, kids in the schools, teachers reporting an increase in bullying because Donald Trump can do it, they can do it. And And the main thing I would say is fear. Fear among people of color, fear among particularly the immigrant community, thinking that even though they went through such hard times in the last 8 years with so many deportations, that it's going to be even worse now under Trump. Parents having to explain to their kids how this might affect them. And I think all the while, you know, us wondering, how the hell did we get here? And what kind of country, even if it is only a quarter of the portion of the voting public, how did we get to this place? So while we are in the depths of grief, and it's funny because when Donald Trump won, I remember thinking, all right, I've got to be always the upbeat one. I'll put on my Facebook, don't mourn, organize. And then people wrote, come on. Give us a break. We got to do some mourning here and some reflecting. And I think it is important. I took it back. It's important to mourn. And it's really important to reflect. And it's important to step back and think, what does this mean for our country and what does it mean for the world? And so I'm coming here very raw still, trying to think, what does it mean for our foreign policy? Because really, I have no idea. We've heard all kinds of things. And in fact, there were many people during this electoral season who were saying, you know, Donald Trump would be better for foreign policy than Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton, we know her record. We know she's a hawk. We know that she is pushing for further involvement in Syria, including a no-fly zone that could lead us into a war with Russia. And that was scaring a lot of people. And so when Donald Trump talked about wanting to be friends with the Russians, many people thought, well, that's a good thing. Yeah. No, that's a positive thing right now. Also, in the debates, it was quite remarkable. I don't know if you remember when there were the debates that Jeb Bush was still in there. Right. Yeah. And Donald Trump was like, your brother got us into that horrible war in Iraq, and that was the biggest, fattest mistake that I've ever seen in my life. And there were no weapons of mass destruction, and he knew it, and he lied to the American people.
Yeah.
And we were thinking, wait a minute, right on. This is good. Except, of course, then he also said that torture was just fine. We should go further than waterboarding. It was okay to kill the families of suspected terrorists, because that would teach him a lesson. And then he talked about bombing the shit, those are his words, the bombing the shit out of ISIS with no recognition that this is an urban war that we're talking about. What does that mean for the population? He also said at one point it would require 30,000 troops to go in. So he has said just about everything you can imagine and then taken it back. So remember, at one point, people were saying, wow, pretty cool. He said that Israel and Palestine, he would not take sides. Remember when he said that? But then he went back and he said, well, I guess I would take sides. Because it's hard not to take sides, especially when you're going to go speak in front of AIPAC. And then he went even further and he said settlements should keep going. And he said he would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the U.S. embassy there, which is going even further in U.S. policy. He has said Iran, the Iran nuclear deal, which was the signature achievement of the Obama administration. You know, we can talk all we want, and I'm happy to do it, about how bad Obama's policies have been. With drone warfare, with bombing 7 different countries, majority Muslim countries. But the one good thing in his foreign policy, well, diplomatic relations with Cuba is a good thing, and the Iran nuclear deal. The best thing he did, and he did it with our support, but with a lot of opposition from Israel, from Saudi Arabia, and from the large lobby groups like AIPAC. and took them on. And here comes Donald Trump, and he says, Iran deal is the worst deal I've ever seen in my life. I would rip that up on day one. And then he kind of went back when somebody told him, well, you know, it's a multilateral agreement. You can't just rip it up because the U.S. is not the only one that signed it and it would still be in effect. And he said, oh, well, then I would just change it. And he's talked about increasing sanctions, not just on Iran, but on the countries that were the signatories to the agreement and have already begun doing business with Iran, and use the U.S. banks to do that, which would really piss off the Iranians, given that we haven't, he even lifted some of the sanctions that we were supposed to as part of that deal. The Iranians could then pull out of that deal, and then where would we be? On the other hand, you have the Russians that are helping the Iranians, and he wants to be friends with the Russians. So go figure what's he gonna do on that one. I just came back from Europe, and I was at the Stop the War Coalition in the UK, which is a really wonderful, dynamic, vibrant group that has forced their government to do a lot more than we've been able to do here, like do the Chilcot Report, looking at who lied to get them into the war in Iraq. But they were saying a couple of things that they were very nervous about. One, of course, they thought Hillary Clinton would win, and they were nervous about the relationship with Russia. But they also talked about the nuclear issues. And they said, you know, you used to have a really strong anti-nuclear movement in the United States back in the 80s. What happened to that movement? And they said, you know that Obama is breaking the conditions of the non-proliferation treaty by, instead of pulling back and getting rid of nuclear weapons, he's pledged now $1 trillion in the next 30 years to modernize nuclear weapons. Well, Donald Trump has said that he's all into modernizing nuclear weapons, and you might remember that he said at one time that it was okay if South Korea, Japan, and the Saudis got nuclear weapons to defend themselves. And then when there was a bit of an outcry about that, he said, well, maybe not. In Europe, they also talked about NATO, and they said, look, we're not trying to defend Russia, but I don't know that people in your country understand how many of the Russians feel betrayed, particularly around NATO. And why don't the American people speak out more about NATO? And they said, Donald Trump, the best thing that they thought he said was that NATO was obsolete. Yep. Of course, then he went back on that one too. Then he went back on that and he said, well, the NATO countries should pay more of their fair share. And the Stop the War Coalition was saying, do the American people understand that NATO has violated the agreements they made with Gorbachev that said that NATO would not encroach further east on Russia's border? And they've gone ahead and done that. And they also said, do the American people understand, and I said, understand, they don't even know, that NATO has been carrying out the largest military exercises right on Russia's border since the Cold War, mm-hmm. with over 30,000 troops involved. So their concern was to say, why aren't the American people speaking out about this? And wondering if indeed Donald Trump might be the one who would do something like really dismantle NATO. The other thing we should recognize is that Donald Trump did say that our military was a big mess and that he was going to fix it. And part of that fix was to increase the size of the military. And the military, the Air Force, the Marines, the Guard, all of it. He was going to increase the size of the Air Force fleet. And so one of the things that happened immediately when Donald Trump was elected that should give us some indication is that the stocks for the weapons industry went soaring up immediately. And the analysts said a couple of things. One, they know that Donald Trump said he was going to increase the size of the military. And they also knew that he is so pro-business that the only manufacturing that still is vibrant in this country is the weapons industry. And that he was going to be more business friendly even to that weapons industry and give them more tax breaks and reduce barriers to the sales overseas, like for the weapons industry. So the stocks on that went soaring. The other thing we should look at is who is he surrounding himself with? I mean, here is the incredible irony of somebody who says that he's an outsider and he's against the DC lobbyists and the corruption in Washington, and he surrounds himself with the very people who are the epitome of that. And those are the people who are picking the selections for his cabinet, for this vast administration that he's going to be hiring. And I almost went into a fit of despair when I saw that one of his close advisors is John Bolton.
Yes.
Who, if you don't know who John Bolton is, you're lucky. But when John Bolton is most sort of anti-internationalist, he was, you know, ambassador to the UN at saying that the UN should be lobbed off at the seventh floor. Virulently anti-Russian, cold warrior to the nth degree, and just a mean, nasty, rotten person.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of people that he is bringing into his inner circle. So there's no sense in even thinking, well, maybe he will be better, maybe he will be more of a diplomat. That is not the nature of Donald Trump. And the increase in the military at a time when we need so desperately to cut down the military, to have all the money that we need for the energy crisis we're facing, for the Medicare expansion we need, for the free college education that every young person in this country deserves. We can't go about increasing the military at this point. So I fear that this military-industrial complex that is so powerful already has its grip on Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to talk about what my book is about, Saudi Arabia, because I think this epitomizes the death grip of the military-industrial complex. Because our relationship with Saudi Arabia is key to whether we stay in endless wars in the Middle East or whether we find a way out of it. And we have to go back to the founding of Saudi Arabia, which originally was a cultish-like figure, Muhammad Wahhab, who started a fundamentalist cultish version of Islam, which my Muslim friends say, please don't call it a version of Islam, call it a perversion of Islam, because it does not represent the vast majority of Muslims in this country, in the world. And this cultish figure would have gone down very quickly as precisely a cultish figure, had it not been for an arrangement he made with a very ambitious Saudi family, the Saud family. And remember, when you think of Saudi Arabia, you're talking about a country named after a family.
Yes.
The Saud family. And that relationship gave the Saud family, a very ambitious family in the 1700s, a religious justification to go around killing and conquering. Because it basically said, if you don't think and interpret the Quran the way I do, you're an infidel and it's okay to kill you. So they used that, went around killing and conquering, and by the 1930s was able to declare this kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And to think to this day, the reign has been passed down from one son to the next, to the next, to the next, so that they're finally at the point where the last one can barely sit up and they have to figure out, you know, who's going to be the next to inherit the throne. But this is the country that exists today because of the 1930s discovery of oil. And it had it not been for the discovery of oil, they would have been overthrown a long time ago. But when oil was discovered by U.S. companies, in fact, the company that is now Chevron today, the U.S. government decided it was very important to have a relationship with this country and to make sure that its leaders stayed in power. And so we began something called the Oil for Security Pact, which was basically, we don't care what your country is like internally, we'll make sure nobody overthrows you as long as you allow our Western companies to make a lot of money from your oil and you sell us that oil. And that pact has been going on for decades now, 12 different administrations. It will be 13 now with Donald Trump. Republicans, Democrats. And in the meantime, what has Saudi Arabia become? It is perhaps the most intolerant country in the world. It is a country that uses the death penalty for all kinds of reasons, all kinds of nonviolent reasons. In fact, I imagine that many of you in the room would be eligible for the death penalty. Let's see a show of hands how many atheists are in the room. How many people identify with the homosexual community? How many people are sorcerers? That's probably most of you here. All of these would be reasons for the death penalty in Saudi Arabia, and the majority of the way the death penalty is executed is by beheadings. That's right. They even have a more gruesome thing called crucifixion, which is where they cut the head off and tie the person up with the head off on the side and leave them out in public for several days as a warning to the rest of the population. I mean, this is a country where you could be imprisoned. And in fact, there was a young man called Raif Badawi who was sentenced to death originally for a blog. He had a blog that was talking about how they needed to be more free thinkers in Saudi Arabia. And maybe there should be more liberalism. And for this, he was accused of insulting the kingdom, of spreading atheism. First sentenced to death. And then, because his wife is brilliant, fled the country with his three kids and started a campaign, they commuted it to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes. I mean, this is a medieval kind of... His lawyer was sentenced to 15 years in prison. You know, it's interesting how our government, and you mentioned in the introduction how I go into these hearings all the time. And when you go into the hearings that are around terrorism, you know, why aren't we able to end terrorism? Maybe you need more money. Maybe you need more weapons. And then they start talking about the country that is the worst spread of extremism around the world. And that, they say, is?
Saudi Arabia.
No, not Saudi Arabia. No, they don't say USA. Come on. Somebody said it. Iran. They say Iran. And then they go and say, you know, and Iran is so repressive. Look at, their elections are not free and fair. The government vets who's able to run. And you say, hello. There are no national elections at all in Saudi Arabia, much less free and fair. They don't even bother to elect a president, a prime minister, a congress, an assembly, anything like that. And, you know, there is no free speech, there's no free press, there's no freedom of assembly. You think in a country that is a theocracy, they might have some respect for religious freedom? If you don't follow the Wahhabi Sunni version or perversion of Islam, then you are discriminated against, whether you are a Sufi, for example, or part of the Shia minority, or a non-Muslim. In fact, it's the only country in the world where it's illegal to build a non-Muslim place of worship. So if you wanted to build a church, illegal. It's funny, you know, when we do go to Congress, I often bring a Saudi friend of mine, and she's a young woman. And I told her, you know, a lot of these Congress people think they're really great Christians. And so why don't you go up to them and say something to them? So she says, all right, you know, is that a Christian congressman? I said, yeah, sure, they're all Christian. So she goes up to him and she says, hi, sir, are you a good Christian? And he says, well, yes, I'm a good Christian. And she says, then why are you selling weapons to the only country in the world where it's illegal to build a church? And they're totally like, don't know the answer to that one. And something, you know, we found out is that there is a law in the United States passed in 1998 that says that we will study every year what countries are the worst in terms of discrimination of people on the basis of their religion or lack of religion, and they will be sanctioned. They will be called countries of concern, and they'll be sanctioned. So every year, we taxpayers pay for the study, and every year they find countries like North Korea, bottom, sanctioned. Burma, bottom, sanctioned. Saudi Arabia, bottom, no sanctions. And I was, you know, so I was doing the research for the book. I was like, why? How? It's in the law. They have to be sanctioned. And it turned out that in 2004, the State Department passed a waiver, not just a waiver, an indefinite waiver, so it doesn't have to be renewed every year, that Saudi Arabia would not be sanctioned for this. And then, you know, it turns out that there's a lot of non-Muslims living in Saudi Arabia, and that's because there's a huge foreign worker population. Huge. So out of 30 million Saudis, 10 million of them are foreigners. And then comes the issue, not just that of those 10 million, several million of them are Christian, they're not allowed to practice their religion in public, but even worse than that is many of them are treated like indentured servants. And you might have heard the Gulf states being infamous for this, but it's called this sponsorship system where, say you wanted to bring someone in for your construction job, and you wanted to bring someone in to work in your house. Well, you then become like the owner of this person. You are their sponsor. Oftentimes, you take their passport as soon as they get in, and many times the workers find out they are not paid what they said they were going to be paid. They're worked 7 days a week. They're not even fed decently. They're abused. The women in the house is often sexually abused. If you say, this is hell, I want to go home, you can't go home because you need an exit visa that can only be given to you by your Saudi employer. So slavery only abolished in 1962. This is a modern day form of slavery. And then let's mention the gender issue. Women, what do you think about Saudi women?
No driving.
So no driving, the only country in the world where women are not allowed to drive. And somebody else said covered in public. Yes, they must be totally uncovered in public. But the worst thing is the guardianship system, which is kind of like the sponsorship system for the migrants. You have to have somebody from the day you're born to the day you die, if you're a female, that is in charge of you and that gets to approve or disapprove of the major things that you want to do in your life, like get married, who you want to marry, when you want to marry, what you want to study, if you're going to be able to get a job, can you get a passport, can you travel. And if you have an enlightened guardian, you can have a pretty good life. If you have an unenlightened guardian, life can be hell for you. And it was I think it was last week, the New York Times did a video, and they put it out on the internet, and they encouraged women from Saudi Arabia to write in to them about the guardianship system, because just recently many thousands of Saudi women signed a petition, which is very brave to do in Saudi Arabia, saying they wanted to lift the guardianship system. And you should have seen these comments flooding in to the New York Times. Again, some saying, my life is fine, I have no problem, I have a good guardian. And others saying, this is like living inside a prison day in and day out. So you have a country that is repressive of the majority of the people living in that country. And then on top of that, they spread this ideology overseas. And that's a pretty new phenomena that started after the 1979 revolution in Iran. Iran, Shia country, Saudi Arabia, majority Sunni. After the Iranian revolution, when the clerics came to power, they said, we are the representatives of true Islam in the world, and the Saudis said, we are, and we're going to spread our version. And so they started building thousands of mosques and schools, not only in the Middle East, but in North Africa, in Europe, in many countries around the world. In fact, I was sitting just the other day with a friend of mine who's from the West Bank, and she said that no, she's from here. She was in the West Bank, and she was in a cafe, and a man came up to her and said, you see that mosque over there? Built by the Saudis. You see the mosque over there? Built by the Saudis. You see the mosque over there? Built by the Saudis. She said, why are they building so many mosques when we have so many other real needs here? This is crazy. And I was in Gaza, where people are suffering from all kinds of deprivations. And the Saudis, they're building these huge, monstrous mosques, which the people are saying the same thing about. That's not our number one priority by far. So the Saudis are going around building these. Well, it's not only that. That would be, you know, so what? It's spreading an ideology, and then it's funding terrorist organizations. And we know that for a fact, and we know that our leaders in this country knew it all along, because now, thanks to WikiLeaks, thanks to Julian Assange, holed up in a hell, you know, in an embassy for years, can't even see the sun, we know that our leaders knew damn well that the Saudis were funding and supporting terrorist groups. Not only Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda affiliates, but also ISIS. There's a cable leak that was from 2014. And you know, we were led to believe that, well, maybe there's some individual Saudis and the government's trying to control them and can't control them. When the cable came out, and this was Julian Assange said this was the most important cable of all the cables leaked, it said that it is the governments, he said, of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the governments, the cable said, that are funding ISIS. So some point you gotta look back and say, you know, what is going on here? Why is our government that says that it's spending trillions of our dollars fighting in this war on terror the good friend of the country most responsible for spreading terrorism around the world? Well, I talked about oil, and that still is an important reason, although we get a lot less of our oil from Saudi Arabia, unfortunately, because of things like fracking in this country. But in any case, less oil. But there's other things that we have become very dependent, or the 1%, I should say, has become very dependent on. And one of them is precisely weapons sales. So I couldn't believe, when I did the research for this book, the amount of weapon sales that the Saudis are buying is astronomical. And if you look at just during the Obama years alone, nice Obama, Nobel Peace Prize winning Obama, sold $115 billion worth of weapons to this repressive, terrorist-spawning Saudi regime. And to put that in proportion, some of you I know here have been working on the issue of Israel and Palestine and the money that our tax dollars going to Israel, which has been about $3 billion a year. So if you multiply that for Obama's tenure of 8 years, that would be $24 billion. which is a lot of money. Compare that to $115 billion in sales to the Saudis. It means that the Saudis have been propping up our military-industrial complex. We have never had sales so huge in the history of the United States. And it is by far the number one purchaser. So you got to really turn this around at some point and say, yeah, we can criticize the Saudis all we want, but what about criticizing ourselves and our weapons dealers here who don't care who they are selling to? They don't care that this is such a repressive regime that beheads people for peaceful protests. They don't care that they're selling weapons to the Israeli government that's oppressing Palestinians every day. They don't care that they're selling money to the Egyptian government that came to power in a coup that put 40,000 people in prison. They don't care. And our congresspeople don't care either, because guess what? They get money from these weapons manufacturers, because these weapons manufacturers make weapons in every single congressional district of the United States. And then they give money to the congresspeople for their elections, and then the congresspeople turn around and push for more weapons sales and more weapons purchases by our government. And it was really funny when the Pope came last year. You might have noticed that when he was addressing Congress, one of the greatest things he said was, he said, why are we selling weapons to people who use it in such abusive ways to hurt so many people? The answer, he said, is money. It's money that's drenched in blood. And we are complicit if we are silent. We must stand up to the arms industry. And these congresspeople jumping up and down and clapping, yeah! They're the very ones who take money from the weapons industry. They're the very ones who themselves are addicted to the military-industrial complex. So this brings us almost full circle. I just want to add a couple of things about Saudi Arabia, which is it's not only the weapon sales. They invest hundreds of billions of dollars in our economy to have leverage. And that is everything from treasury bonds to real estate. They said they bailed Donald Trump out twice, to oil refineries in Texas, to companies like Uber, where they invested $3.5 billion, enough to get a seat on the board, which is quite funny given that half the population can't drive. They give money to universities, especially Ivy League schools. Also quite funny, they gave $10 million to the Yale Law School. And I say that's funny because there's no rule of law in Saudi Arabia. They give money to think tanks in Washington, which is funny too, because you could never have a think tank in Saudi Arabia. But they give to the left, to the right. They give to the Brookings Institute and the Atlantic Council. They give to many foundations, like the Clinton Foundation, $10 to $25 million to the Clinton Foundation. They give to Jimmy Carter's Foundation. They give to John McCain's Foundation. They give to, well, they hire a lot of lobbyists to put a happy face on this terrible regime. And these lobbyists tend to be former congresspeople and former members of the military. One of the big lobbyists is called the Podesta Group. Anybody heard of Podestas? So John and Tony Podesta started the Podesta Group. John went off to become the chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign, and Tony became a paid foreign agent for the Saudi government, getting $140,000 a month to represent the Saudi regime. So these are just some of the ways that we are intertwined, or our government, or our leaders, in quotes, are intertwined with the Saudis. So that brings me back again to Donald Trump and where we are and how we're going to move forward, whether it was Hillary Clinton or it's Donald Trump now in the White House. I think that it will resonate with you in the room that under George Bush, we had a very vibrant peace movement. You remember that? Our peace movement was young and old. It was black and white and Latino. It was diverse. It was energetic. We could get hundreds of thousands. No, we could get millions of people out on the streets. We had the largest demonstrations in the history of humankind on February 15th, 2003, that went down in the Guinness Book of Records. We were a force. Unfortunately, George Bush went ahead with that war, and people got frustrated after 8 years of protesting and thought that President Obama was going to be a peace president. So a lot of people let down their guard. A lot of people were also struggling financially because a financial crisis happened. A lot of people wanted to work on something where they could see more immediate results and went to work in environmental issues and all kinds of other issues for many reasons, many good reasons too. People just left the peace movement. And we ended up being a very, very small group of people, proportionally speaking, a majority white and majority older. And that's where we are now. That's not going to work as a peace movement that's going to have some impact. But you know what? Neither are these other movements going to work unless we recognize that we have to build a different kind of movements that are not in the silos that we used to have. Let's face it, it's not that you're a peace person and I'm not an environmentalist, right? You an environmentalist? Yeah. And a peace person, and anti-racist, and you want people to get a decent living wage, and you don't want immigrants to be mistreated. I mean, we are holistic people. And to see what Bernie Sanders was able to accomplish in his campaign, I don't know about you, but here again, I was really wrong, because I was part of a group. I'm an independent and a green and a Democrat. I don't see the contradiction. Some of my friends say there is one. But I'm on the board of the Progressive Democrats of America. And in 2014, when we had our annual meeting, our leader at that time, since unfortunately deceased, Tim Carpenter, said, "We're going to get Bernie Sanders here, and we're going to push for him to run." And I'm thinking, oh God, Bernie Sanders. I see him in the halls in the Senate all the time. He's not even nice. You know, he's curmudgeonly. He never looks up. He doesn't give you a smile. They said, "We're going to push Bernie Sanders to run." So, you know, we got all these signs, "Run, Bernie, run." And it was the first time any group was pushing Bernie Sanders to run. And I was there with my sign, and I was really thinking, come on. If he runs, be lucky to get 5%. Really lucky to get 5%. I had no idea that this curmudgeonly, elderly, Jewish guy, a socialist to top it off, would become a hero, not only to older folks like many of us, but to the young generation. It was just a marvelous thing to see, an amazing thing to see. And it showed this wellspring of people saying, "We've had enough. This is not about one issue or another issue. This is about the system." And to see that there were polls, I almost fell over when I read a poll in the Washington Post that said for the millennials, they had a more favorable view of socialism than of capitalism. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I have kids that age. I wouldn't believe it. So, of course, it said in the same thing, they didn't know what socialism is, but neither do we, so who does? Yeah, right, we know what capitalism is, yeah. And that's the point. We know the system we have is failing us, is failing the planet, is failing the future generations. We know the system we have does not work and cannot continue, that a system that's based on growth is a system that has no future. It has to be a system that's based on something different, that's based on well-being, that's based on community, that's based on localism, that's based on compassion, a totally different system that's based on how do we keep this beautiful planet going so that in the next generations there will be one. That's the system that we need to be looking towards. And so as I look at what's happened just in the last couple of days, yes, the mourning, yes, the reflection, but I'm actually very excited.
Yes.
I have seen the kinds of demonstrations in the last few days that we have not seen before. I mean, first let's remember, we already have a very vibrant Black Lives Matter movement.
Yes.
Let's remember that we have an historic indigenous movement for the environment at Standing Rock. Let's remember we have a vibrant movement for a $15 an hour wage. And let's remember we have a vibrant immigrant rights movement. So it's not like there aren't movements. But now we see something different. It's not about one movement or the other. It's people coming out to say no to the system, yeah. And Donald Trump is not the answer to the problems that we see. And it's people coming out, mostly young people, and they came out the first night, they came out the second night, the third night, the fourth night. Yeah. And it keeps going, and it's all over the country. And Donald Trump can say all he wants that these are professional protesters. And I hear them saying, I wish I were professional. Maybe that would mean somebody would pay me for a change. But this is our movement writ large. Yes. This is our peace and justice movement that we are part of. And now we see so many other people that are no longer willing to sit back.
Yeah.
And we see not only coming out of the universities, teach-ins everywhere, but we see it in the high schools. And my friends who are high school teachers said they never thought they'd see this in their lifetime. The high school students demanding they stop classes to talk about what's happening. Woo-hoo! And walking out of class. So there is a lot going on. I even see in Washington, D.C., which is the swamp of this system, that there is suddenly, after or in addition to the mourning, there is this sense of we got to get moving. So already my inbox is flooded with things saying, okay, we now have secured the African American Museum, the brand new museum, for the night before the inauguration to have a massive peace ball. We've already decided, different groups calling it and saying, let's all do it together, which is we need a massive protest the day of the inauguration.
Yes. Yes.
And then a woman who just put it out on her own Facebook, first calling it a Million Women's March, and turned around and immediately she had 30,000 people signed up on her Facebook for a Women's March the day, 2 days after the inauguration. So things are stirring like never before. So as we mourn and we think of, oh my God, how am I going to survive 4 years of seeing this man and knowing that he's in the White House, on the other hand, we're going to be very, very busy.
Yes.
And we're going to have more activism than we have seen in the majority of our lifetimes. And let's remember, some of the best movements have come out of some of the darkest times, like the McCarthy era, what came after that? The Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, the Gay Rights Movement. So this is a time of movement building, and I really do think we're going to be able to get out of our silos, to be intergenerational, to be multi-ethnic, to be totally inclusive, and to build the most progressive movement that we have seen in decades that will force even Donald Trump to stop some of the worst things that he's planning to do, and better yet, get even some better policies than we were able to get with 8 years of the Obama administration, because we couldn't get this kind of people's power out there. So I want to end on a positive note. Let's get out there and build this movement. The doors are open now. Let's run through them. Thank you.